Would you like me to begin, Carl?
Yes, why don't you start, Don, with this interview with Don Bybee. What was your initial position? And you can go ahead with question one, two, or three right there.
Sure. I was hired to come to Stony Brook as a quadrangle director in the then Dean of Students office. I was a quadrangle director and an assistant dean, I think, for budgeting purposes. I came in 1965.
Student personnel?
Mm-hmm.
Student personnel.
Yep.
And you came in 19?
I came in 1965. 65. I was 24. I came from Michigan State University, where I had worked in residence halls as an emissary of the Dean of Students office there. Michigan State had just made a major commitment to marrying the living and learning activities by bringing them together in the same facilities. And I think I was thought to be interesting for Stony Brook as a participant in that process, although certainly a very lowly participant. My decision to come here was made after attending the NASPA convention in Washington, D.C. that spring. NASPA, National Association of Student Personnel Administrators. At that time, it was a major distribution center. Yes, every brand new MA or PhD who wanted to work in an institution other than the one where he or she was went to the NASPA conference, and it was very good for that purpose. As it turned out, even before I registered for the conference, I ran into an old friend from Michigan State in the lobby by the name of John Herr. John, who has an ambiguous reputation at Stony Brook presently. John, at that time, was the Associate Dean of Students, reporting to Dave Tilley. We had worked at Michigan State together in a couple of projects, one of which was the University Theater, the other of which was one of the Living Learning Centers, where I was most recently from. We patted each other on the back and brought each other up to date on what was happening. He was there recruiting people. I was there to be recruited. Within a half an hour, I was sitting down with Dave Tilley. And lo and behold, before the conference had begun, I had a pretty strong feeling that I would be offered a position at Stony Brook. And additionally, I thought I would probably take it. David was quite impressive, looking so much like a Kennedy, and in his quiet, soft-spoken way. Why did I come? The major factors were that I'd grown tired of graduate study at Michigan State, and it was a pretty sure bet that a position here or a similar position elsewhere would be draft deferrable, and indeed it was. Looking for draft deferred work that seemed interesting were the major factors in my decision to come here, knowing nothing about the institution. In my Midwestern naivete, assuming it was quite urban. And to my surprise, when I exited exit 56 and disappeared into the boondocks. I think I was given a pretty good understanding in response to question number seven here about the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook and something of the vision that was being transformed into reality. Just before I had signed on at Stony Brook, you, Carl, and others had the good fortune to recruit Johnny Toll, who was also looking for work at the time. and we arrived at roughly the same time on campus. I think the institution's goals and as they fit in with the larger institution goals were quite clear at that point. And expressed, I think, quite articulately by Johnny and you and others who were in charge of articulating goals at that point. Becoming the Berkeley of the East seemed like a crass way to put it, but it did indeed capture some of the flavor of Berkeley or a Caltech. Stony Brook, when I first came, lived up to its billing as of being a showplace for neo-penal architecture. It was small and undistinguished in appearance, still exhibiting a lot of the pioneer spirit. The dormitory where my apartment was located, I think I was the first human being to occupy the place. Much was brand new at that point.
H-Quad
in what is now called Langmuir College, which was then called JN. let me see, question eight. Not too pretty and a little primitive were the initial impressions of it in an aesthetic sense. In terms of the people here, a major factor among staff and students at that time was Oyster Bay nostalgia. People still weren't over the shock of moving operations all the way out here.
Now this is faculty and students?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Both?
Faculty and students both. It wasn't an unpleasant phenomenon to be around, but it was certainly very much in the air. Stony Brook was so new that there was very little history to talk about here on the ground.
The golden age, in a sense.
Indeed,
In that sense.
Yeah. If you couldn't be the University of Chicago, Oyster Bay was next best, I guess. Events and persons standing out in my mind.
Let me ask you one more question about that. As an ideal for the campus to realize in terms of faculty-student relations and faculty relationships, how long did it persist, and did it have any effect in influencing people's behavior here on the campus?
Well, I think from the beginning of my experience here, there was a divided opinion on the priorities that were appropriate. There were the official ones articulated by Johnny and people at his level, and indeed by Albany. And there were the on-the-ground versions of that. The institution from the beginning was clearly committed to a shining future, and it seemed to many that the day-to-day life on the campus was always available to be compromised or sacrificed for the future. And so it seemed, especially as when time went on, construction began happening at such a great rate, and so much was disrupted. Just the prevalence of dirt and mud and bad tempers as people tried to accommodate to all that. But I think there was at the beginning, and there persisted a division of opinion on what ought to be going on.
Can you be more specific about that?
students and some faculty were under the impression that insufficient attention was being paid to the day-to-day quality of life on campus in the interests of keeping the formal eye on the future. And there was a great deal daily to reinforce that view. The residential college plan was thought to be a means of addressing the day-to-day quality of life issues, as well as augmenting the intellectual stimulation and merit of the institution, and it just never flew, as far as I could tell.
Why?
I don't know, Carl. I was from a system where we had successfully arranged for faculty to be in residence at a very great rate, and they would climb over one another to get there. We had arranged for auditoria, libraries, laboratories, classrooms, and very commodious faculty offices to be built in the residence halls. And faculty members were more than happy to trade in their 100-year-old office for something that was bright and shiny and new. And, you know, it was routine to have Edward Teller or Margaret Mead or Paul Goodman to go marching through the dorms to do this or that colloquium or whatever. And learning and living were truly paired there. We never experienced anything like that here.
I remember Margaret Mead coming here one time.
I do too, yeah. But in terms of the so-called residential college plan, it just never seemed to work. And not only did it not start auspiciously, soon thereafter came the student movement of the high 60s, student movement so-called. And it seemed to me that within 3 or 4 years, much of the academic credibility and leadership had eroded at Stony Brook. I remember Homer Goldberg mentioning once, I hope Homer has a chance to hear this or hear of it and correct it if I'm citing him wrong, but Homer defined academic integrity among his peers and colleagues as anyone who'd given a C in the last 3 years. Even though it isn't and wasn't true, it certainly captured the flavor of the times. How shall we go, Carl?
Well, what about the difference in the student body between here and between Stony Brook and let's say Michigan State?
Yeah, let me see. The differences in hindsight now, it's easy for me to say the differences were not very pronounced, although at the time it seemed to me there were significant differences. Stony Brook students, oddly enough, seemed a little more worldly, a little more world-weary maybe, a little smoother than the average Michigan State student. But with just the merest bit of hindsight, one can see that Michigan State students were really very cosmopolitan compared to the average Stony Brook student, who was really pretty parochially Long Island.
Manhattan and Long Island?
Yeah. You know, not comfortable in the same room with an international student wearing garb from home, whereas Michigan State students had always been accustomed to that. It was just standard that they wore native costume on campus, and the availability of people from other countries was thought to be a boon, you know, an opportunity to learn and broaden one's horizons. And we never got that cosmopolitan here. Efforts of several foreign student advisors notwithstanding.
Was there any change while you were involved in the residential college program in the point of view of students? Was it any evolution in attitude or quality? You were here during the bust, too.
Indeed, I was.
And what were the effects of that?
That's a difficult question. The evolution of the students, it's hard to say what happened by attrition and new students coming in with different ideas and what happened while they were here. Part of what was happening at that time, if memory serves, is we were able to be more and more selective each year in our admissions, and we were attracting more and more of the better students graduating in Long Island and in New York. Maybe they were brighter students coming in, I don't know. The bust is certainly a major event in Stony Brook's history. I don't know whether it did anything other than consolidate kind of an anti-establishment mentality among students and younger faculty and staff, one that seemed to be well on its way before the bust happened.
Did you see the TV brochure that was gotten out by the Suffolk Police Department, about half an inch thick, and given to the media?
I think I did
beforehand.
See that. Yes, I think I did see that.
That was quite a production.
Well, they were certainly very committed to seeing what they needed to see here on campus. The police were under their leadership at the time. I don't know how the DA figured into that, although we had active liaison with the DA all along. But they certainly...
Now, let's see, which DA was this?
The one before O'Brien. Harry was his aide.
I see. I don't remember.
I can't remember his name at the moment. I don't think he was much of a lawyer. I think he was more of a politician. But the university and the police were operating in separate worlds, absolutely, despite the fact that I personally was led to believe that we were on the same team. I was the in-house narc at that time and taking a lot of heat here on campus.
In-house what?
Narc. Narcotics officer.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Mm.
And we were dealing with what we now know was the tip of the iceberg, but at the time it seemed to us that we were dealing with monumental issues and numbers of students and had really no idea how extensive and pervasive the use of illegal drugs was. The police did, in fact, have an idea, but they never shared that with us. They let us go on thinking that we were doing something they wanted done. And lo and behold, it was a long exercise in bad faith.
Well, in 63 or 64, when we had the burning of a small wooden house out here by one of the maintenance people, a young chap, and who was taken into custody. I remember being over there at the time that he was arraigned, and one of the members of the Suffolk Narcotics Squad told me that it was coming out the island, that is, the drugs were coming out the island, and that if they hadn't hit us yet, they would. They had a picture of it that I don't think we had at the time.
Well, I guess if they had any picture at all, they did. They had one that we didn't have. It was inconceivable to them that we didn't know what they thought
they
knew.
Yeah.
Mike McGrady who's reviewing movies, I think, for Newsday Now at the time. If you don't have in your archives a copy of the article that he wrote just post-bust, I think it was probably the sanest piece of prose to come out of that era. I don't even remember the details now. I just remember that was the first time that I'd read something under his byline, but he wrote a very nice sociological, historical description of the time, it seemed to me.
Your title of it? Does it have it?
No, but I'll bet you that somewhere in somebody's file there will be copies of it. I'm not sure that the university didn't reprint copies of it. I'll look in what files I retain and
Mark
see if there's anything.
McGrady.
Mike McGrady.
Mike McGrady.
Mm-hmm. He's currently still with Newsday, so.
I see. Okay. All right. Any particular members of the faculty stand out in your mind as being particularly interested in students, close to students, guide, philosopher, and friend, so to speak?
The one who stands head and shoulders above all others in recollection at this point is Norman Goodman. Mm-hmm. Norman was from the very beginning, and every week since then has been an advocate of students on this campus, has been a contributor to the quality of student life on this campus, has been a tireless partisan of Stony Brook students in Stony Brook, as far as I can tell.
By partisan now, what do you mean?
Advocate, representative, defender.
Why did the students need to be defended?
Oh, I don't think they did, but Norman was there before they got interested in it, and he's still there long after they stopped being interested in it. He's someone who really dedicated himself to the institution through thick and thin. Jim Fowler is another one who comes to mind right now. Jim could and would do anything for the institution, including serve in ad hoc in various administrative capacities. But he would go down to the wire for the institution at any point.
What about Max Dresden?
I never had much to do with Max. He certainly spoke a great deal at faculty meetings and other kinds of meetings, and he clearly had a following of people who admired his approach to things, but I never had that much to do with Max.
What about Stan Ross?
Nor him. I had a friend who was a graduate student studying with him. We came to Stony Brook at the same time, but I didn't have a clear sense about.
Well, he had his own job to do, which was with faculty and curriculum. When did Larry DeBoer come?
Larry came probably in 67, would be my guess. Hired to head up the residential college plan.
How did he work out?
I really don't know, Carl. I think he was invited into a sinking ship at the very beginning.
I see.
I don't know what the verdict is on that.
Dave Tilley is coming over next week.
That's super. I hope I get a chance to talk to him.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say.
Yeah. David is another one who worked tirelessly on behalf of the institution and the students here. I think that oftentimes it was not apparent how hard and diligently he was working, and David was never one to blow his own horn very much. So he wasn't given to bold public statements and pontificating, but David was a very hard worker.
My impression was that we got quite a lot of unfinished business from the home in the students that we were recruiting, or who came to us. In other words, that they weren't housebroken.
Oh, that's still the case, Carl, I think, very much. Stony Brook's location is such that it's always been a wonderful compromise school for the youngster who doesn't want to stay at home, but doesn't want to go very far west of the Hudson either. So you come to Stony Brook and you're an hour from home. And you're away, but not away.
Yeah.
You're home, but you're not really home.
Well, I also meant by housebroken that they were not accustomed to being very neat about public rooms, not above graffiti and defacing walls and things of that sort.
That got to be standard. That got to be a norm at some point in the 70s, maybe. In the beginning, it wasn't that way, in my perception here, just in terms of a fuller view of the history. We were served very well in those early years by members of the housekeeping and maintenance staff. And in the building where I lived initially on campus, there was a great relationship between the people charged with keeping the place clean and the youngsters who lived there, to the point where a mess wouldn't be made for fear that they knew the people who would have to clean it up, and they didn't want them to do that. Or if they did, were in error, those people would track them down the next day and remind them of their obligations. But there did come a point a few years after that where a real indifference to the physical plan got established and is with us yet. I don't think there's as much vandalism as there used to be, but still there is an indifference to the physical plan. It was stunning in those years to go to another campus.
Yeah.
And I went back to alma mater one time. And
where was your alma mater?
Michigan State.
Michigan State.
And I was just so used to the grime and the indifference here, and walked into a building where a friend of mine was working, and it was just breathtaking. There was one Coke can in a lounge of about an acre, and that was quickly spirited away while we stood there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. What is your particular function now? What are you doing now?
Presently, I'm a senior counselor in the counseling center here, which is a sub-agency of the Student Affairs Office.
Okay. What kind of counseling do you do?
Whatever is needed as someone comes through the door. The bulk of our work is crisis intervention and short-term or time-specified psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
We're all licensed social workers or psychologists, and do, if I do say so myself, a good job, a good professional job.
Are we getting more of that kind, or is the incidence declining, or is it pretty steady function of the kind of people we get?
Which kind, Carl?
Students, I mean. I'm talking about...
Okay, my dear. Come by the house.
About the people who come into your office with problems. Are they sent to you? Do they come of their own accord?
Well,
which?
Both.
Both?
Mm-hmm. I would say the bulk of them, maybe 60%, come on their own hook. 40% are probably referred of that 40%, maybe half by faculty members, half by mm-hmm. fellow students.
Mm-hmm. What kind of problems? Family?
Family is always an issue. The past is always present in that sense. I think the problems we deal with are probably very much like the problems dealt with by a comparable sized institution serving a comparable clientele. We may have more students who are a larger proportion who are in the throes of family issues, of independence issues, of separation issues, because of our location. We still have a preponderance of our undergraduates are very local. We see a good many graduate students, though, and they're yes, yeah. And their problems are standard brand. You know, how to do this PhD before the money runs out, and, you know.
Discrepancy between what the family would like to have the undergraduate do and what the undergraduate wants to do. Is there much pressure on our undergraduates to achieve?
By and large, I would guess the pressure is less these days than it used to be. Less family pressure, less internal pressure. That's judging from the sample I see.
What about the family home? Is father or mother a college graduate?
Probably not in most cases, although unlike the situation 10 years ago, one or both may have some college experience.
Now, I see. What about first generation American, second generation American?
Most of those whom I've run across recently have been Asian.
Asian, mm-hmm. I see.
The most recent immigrants have been Asian.
We have a sizable number then.
We do indeed.
Where were you when Kennedy was assassinated? You were not here.
I was at Michigan State.
You were at Michigan State. Yeah. Did that have much of an impact on the students?
Absolutely. It stopped everything. For days.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I guess everybody answers that question these days. I remember who I was with and what we were talking about, who brought the news, mm-hmm. and how we spent the rest of the day and all that business. The other early experience of that kind of encompassing was the night the lights went out here. I guess that was in November of 65. When the Northeast went black.
Yeah. Or, oh, yes.
Yeah.
The big blackout. Were you here when one of our students tried to jump across one of these open vents, fell in?
Indeed I was. I remember his name.
You do? Was that a dare?
I don't know, Carl. My impression is that the students involved were not behaving nearly as prudently as they might. But if I ever knew, I don't remember what the exact circumstances were.
Well, have any relations with Albany?
None that were of any merit or substance.
Now go ahead and recollect incidents. Anything that you can remember.
Let's see. From what? From the very earliest time?
The earliest time for you, yes. Department chairman?
I remember J.D. Reed and Jim Harrison, two of Herb Weisinger's minions in the English department. Harrison was Weisinger's administrative assistant, and J.D. was a master's candidate, I think. Maybe he was a doctoral student. They've both gone on. Harrison is a well-published and critically loved novelist, and Reed is in the hierarchy of Time magazine now. I remember them putting on the whole institution a two-man Vietnam War protest. Mm-hmm. They were going to napalm a pig for everyone's edification. And David Tilley and I, neither one of us thought this was going to happen, but we also thought the better part of prudence was to have someone on the scene. I don't know that there ever was a meeting. I went to the humanities building where this was supposed to happen, I think. Or maybe it was in the chemistry or physics auditorium, I don't know, but I stopped in the John on my way there, and both Reed and Harrison were in there drinking a bottle of Wild Turkey. And I don't think that they ever went to the meeting. It was all a joke, and a good one, it seemed to me at the time. I remember you introducing Johnny at his first, or one of his very first official formal state occasions here on campus.
Presenting him to the faculty?
I don't remember what it was, but whatever it was, he chopped his way out of Sunwood that morning with an axe. Trees had fallen down overnight.
Well, we had chopped also a tree which had fallen over John Gambling's place.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call from him.
Yeah.
It was one of our trees that had fallen across his driveway.
Uh-huh.
He was a little bit upset.
Yeah. One of my favorite recollections is the time that Nelson Rockefeller came to do the first spadeful for, I think, the Earth and Space Sciences building. And the cleaning people in the dormitory where I had my apartment, the same cleaning people I talked of earlier, were just excited beyond belief at this prospect. They were claiming that Rockefeller had helped them get out of Cuba. And we all said, yes, they're there. And but they were very eager to go to this event and made sure that it was okay with everybody if they went, still technically on company time at the moment. And we were all being superior and indulgent. And the event came, and they were at the up near the event, and called out to the governor, who called back by name.
Right?
Yes, so they had a reunion there while the cameras rolled on. It was a delightful event. Rockefeller at his most human.
We owe a lot to him.
Indeed. Indeed.
I wish he were still with us.
Carl, I'm watching my watch.
Go?
Yeah,
right.
I do need to run
all
back
right.
and do my 4 o'clock appointment.
Well, what time is it?
It's about 10 of 4.
10 of, okay. Well, thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
I've run out of questions to ask
well,
you.
Well, if others occur to you, I'll be happy to give you my my opinion on their answer.
Okay.
Very well. Good luck with the project.
Well, thanks.
Sure.
It's interesting. I think people like to, like to talk.
By and large, I think that's so. Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.